Crop FM, Ausgabe Nummer 352. Wir schreiben den 13. Mai 2016. Mein Gast heute Abend ist Toby Grotz und Titel der Sendung ist Tesla's Prophecy. Und auch heute kann man sich wieder live am Gespräch beteiligen über CropCom. Einfach auf die Website gehen von CropFM. Jeder, der das jetzt live hört, ist eh schon dort. CropFM.at. Freue mich natürlich, wenn möglichst viele live zuhören. Einfach einsteigen, Fragen reintippen und ich gebe sie dann sehr gerne an den Gast weiter. Zu dieser Sendung gibt es einen Newsletter, den kann man gratis abonnieren von der Startseite aus, cropfm.at. Dort findet man auch den Mail-Link, einen Podcast, einen RSS-Feed, das Archiv mit allen Sendungen, fast allen Sendungen. Einzelne Sendungen kann man direkt verlinken, ich freue mich drüber. Es gibt ein Forum, auch zur heutigen Sendung wieder ein Thread. Die Illustration zur heutigen Sendung kommt wieder von Matthias Töpfer. Ich finde, Illustration ist eigentlich eine Untertreibung. Also das heutige Bild, finde ich, ist ein Kunstwerk. Wirklich sehr schön gelungen. Matthias Töpfer, mehr zu seiner Kunst auf www.bilderdämmerung.de. Und last but not least, der CropFM Spenden-Button findet sich auch auf der Startseite relativ weit oben. Das ist der Button mit dem rosa Herzen oder roten Herzen, ich weiß gar nicht, was dafür farbgenau ist. Jedenfalls, großes Danke an alle, die ihn schon verwendet haben. Gehostet wird das Ganze von fetznetz.it, fetznetz.it, der Host von CropFM. Planetenjäger Kepler hat weitere 1284 Exoplaneten entdeckt. Ein Artikel erschienen auf Grenzwissenschaft aktuell. Washington, USA, anhand der Beobachtungsdaten des NASA-Weltraumteleskops Kepler haben Astronomen weitere 1284 Planeten außerhalb unseres Sonnensystems, sogenannte Exoplaneten, ausfindig gemacht. Und übrigens wird Helmut Lammer, der einer der Experten weltweit auf dem Gebiet der Exoplaneten ist im Anfang September dieses Jahres wieder zu Gast. Da werden wir sicher auch über das sprechen. Und bei diesem Fund hier handelt es sich um die bislang größte Tranche an von Kepler entdeckten Planeten. Unter den so nachgewiesenen Planeten befinden sich auch einige potenziell lebensfreundliche Felsplaneten. Und erstmals wurden laut einer weiteren Meldung von letzter Woche auch Planeten bei einem roten Zwergstern entdeckt. Also Planeten gibt es überall anscheinend. Und es ist wieder soweit, es geht los. Die Kornkreissaison 2016 wurde eröffnet durch ein schönes Piktogramm, das bei Hillbarn in der Nähe von East Kennet in Wiltshire entdeckt wurde, und zwar am 6. Mai 2016. Ist natürlich wie alles andere, was ich hier vorlese und vieles weitere mehr, von der Startseite, von der News-Sektion aus verlinkt. Sehr schöner Kornkreis. Mal sehen, was es noch alles wird dieses Jahr. Ja, und hier geht's gleich weiter mit Toby Grotz und Teslas Prophecy. Gast Toby Grotz, my guest today, has been effectively managing projects in the energy industry and researching alternative energy systems for over 43 years. His background includes work in exploration, geophysics, the aerospace industry, and in the utility industry. He has been researching alternative energy systems since the first Earth Day and has been involved in research and development of advanced energy generation and transmission systems, including novel applications of hydrogen generation for fuel cells. He has organized and chaired conferences on space energy, including the 1984 Tesla Centennial Symposium and the 1993 and 1994 International Symposium on Energy. Hi, Toby. Welcome to my show.
Thank you.
A very impressive CV, and I don't even know where to start here. There's an awful lot that we can and will talk about today. So 4 decades of searching research into alternative energy, into the so-called free energy. You were one of the founding members, as I take it, of the Institute for New Energy. So what is that all about?
Basically, that was a series of symposiums that were conducted in 93 and 94 based in Fort Collins. And the group put together these conferences funded by a individual that had been high profile in the computer industry in preparation for the 1993 symposium. I had taken a trip around the world to look at the different inventors that were researching alternative energy systems, basically what we call over unity or free energy systems, zero point energy systems, etc. And I spent a month traveling and meeting inventors around the world to encourage them to come to those to that conference to bring their hardware. And so those two symposiums were about assembling inventors and their hardware and then conducting tests in a university laboratory of their hardware. And two of the people that I had visited were Suiji Inamata in Japan, who was working with homopolar generators, also known as N machines, and Paramahamsa Tiwari in India. That was the first time I had met Mr. Tiwari, was on that trip around the world. We had been in correspondence since about 1984, and I'd read lots of his material and was very impressed and thought that of all the people that I'd researched in the new energy field starting about 1980, his was probably the most comprehensive and well laid out theory of how physics actually is put together. So these two conferences, we basically had, at the beginning of these conferences, we had a think tank. We organized the inventors like Tom Bearden and Stefan Marinoff and many others at a hotel in Estes Park, the Stanley Hotel in Estes Park. And we came together and we worked on strategies and we worked on theories. And then we had a conference for the general public where people presented their papers. And that was done 2 years in a row. And it was an effort to not only publicize the work, but try and find funding for the work. So since then, a number of people have gotten funding. Mr. Tiwari has gotten some funding. And I think a lot of progress has been made in terms of finding out which machines work and which machines don't work. So basically those conferences and the Institute for New Energy were put together to try and figure out which machines worked and which inventor really had a novel device and which ones did not.
And as I said, I mean, your CV is really, really long, and you did a lot of stuff in all kinds of fields. And one thing that you also researched are the effects of ELF, so that's extra low frequencies, I guess, magnetic fields on biological systems.
Yes. In 1980, when I first met Tom Bearden at a conference, he was the one that really inspired me to start looking into the discrepancies between quantum mechanics and relativity theory and all the discrepancies in electromagnetic theory. But at that conference, I also met Elizabeth Rauscher and William Bice and Al Bielak, all of who were working in that ELF field, looking at the effects of extreme low frequencies. And about that time, the 60 cycle frequencies of power line generation became suspect, and a lot of studies were starting to be conducted by utility companies and by scientific institutions to determine the effect of frequencies in the 60 cycle range. So it's obvious from the data that these would affect us, and the reason they do have an effect, if you think about it, humans did not evolve subject to any of these frequencies, from low frequencies to cell phone frequencies. So we evolved in a environment that was generally passive, i.e. non-existent electromagnetic energies. We weren't designed, basically, it didn't evolve to handle these energies. We were exposed to electromagnetics in the environment in the 7.8 to 8 cycle per second range, that is generated as a result of lightning strikes all around the world, energizing the resonant cavity around the Earth. So when lightning strikes nearby, it emits electromagnetic fields, and those fields have frequencies from very low in the 1, 2, 3, 7, 8 hertz range all the way up into the AM range. You hear that on an AM radio, you can hear that static. The component of that electromagnetic pulse that is in the 8 cycle per second range resonates inside a cavity that surrounds the Earth, from the Earth surface to the bottom of the ionosphere, some tens of kilometers, there is a resonant frequency, and those waves at 8 cycles per second penetrate, propagate in that resonant cavity. This is something that Tesla started to notice when he was doing his experiments in Colorado Springs back in 1898 or so. He noticed these particular resonances. The term comes from a professor, I think it was University of Arizona, named W.O. Schumann, who actually began to build machines that, or circuits to detect these extremely low frequency fields. And I must say they're very low strength, very, very low strength fields. And so that Schumann cavity resonance has always interested me, because one of the things that people have tried to do is entrain brain waves. And if you build a device that either stimulates the scalp with electrical signals or stimulates the brain with low frequencies, a lot of research has been done on how to influence the states of the brain. For instance, a state of heightened awareness that you might find in a meditator when you're meditating is around 8 cycles per second. I always thought that was interesting, because it's the same frequency as the Schumann cavity of the Earth. And I kind of jokingly always ask myself, if we'd grown up on a planet with a different size, you would have an either higher or lower Schumann cavity resonance. And I wonder if the state of advanced consciousness or the state of advanced awareness on another planet might be relative to the frequency of the resonant cavity around that planet. But Rauscher and Beiss were studying, and Bielak were studying these fields, because there was at the time quite a bit of military research going on. It seemed that, as I recall, the Russians were beaming microwaves at the embassy, U.S. embassy in Russia, and they were modulating those frequencies with low frequency signals. So they were apparently experimenting with how to affect the functioning of the brain. And of course, that all goes behind closed doors. All that work's been done behind closed doors in military work. One of the people that was also interested in this was Andrea Buharic, who was an ND that had worked for the Army during World War II. And he was also involved in that effects of low frequency research on the brain. Of course, the good guys are trying to figure out how to use these frequencies to relax and heal, while the bad guys are trying to figure out how to use these frequencies to affect the brain and cause dysfunction. So it was an interesting time for me. I was building devices that emitted electromagnetic fields at the 7.8 cycles, and I later got into transcutaneous electrical nerve stimulator devices, which are devices that you put electrodes on your head, and then you pulse those electrodes at the frequencies that you're trying to attain through meditation. And we also were experimenting with coupling white noise into those pulses so that you get a broad spectrum of energy. Similar to another device we studied back at that time was the Lakowski multiple wave oscillator. Lakowski was a researcher that came to the United States from Europe, and he was using basically Tesla coils in a small box, and he would connect those Tesla coils to a series of concentric rings and hang those rings on either side of a patient and expose the patient to those frequencies in order to study the healing effects. And he was apparently successful in healing a number of different types of diseases using exposure to electromagnetic radiation. Are we still there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. I just heard a little bit of one of those little bedoying apple.
Yeah, but that didn't come from my side.
Nice, yeah. Okay.
Okay, fascinating stuff. L. Bielak, is that the L. Bielak that was also involved in this Philadelphia project thing?
Yes, he used to bring his car over to my garage and fix his Ford Galaxy.
Oh, my God.
When I lived in Denver, he was working at the same aerospace company I was working at for a time as a contractor, and he was very, very skilled in pulse width modulator power supply design. He was an analog circuit designer, one of the best. And I knew him before he had those revelations. I knew him back when we were basically working on studying this ELF phenomenon and building circuits to measure the ELF.
But isn't he one of the guys who time traveled, or who time traveled? Well, from,
like I said, I knew him before he had that revelation, and I knew him afterwards. But you know, there's this whole Montauk Project thing and this whole time travel thing, and you know, that's one of those things that who knows, you know.
I never got my head around all of this, because he was here before 1984 when he allegedly time traveled from 43, wasn't it?
Yeah, I don't recall. I mean, I've heard it all. Preston Nichols was the guy that wrote the book Montauk Project. I think he was at the 84 Tesla Symposium.
Oh, yeah.
Nichols. So.
So allegedly he arrived here in the year when you held the first Tesla conference in the United States.
Yeah, it could be. Who knows?
Okay, well, another one of those really weird stories where you never get to the end of it, basically. So,
right, exactly.
The way we got in touch was because of the movie Out of the Void, Aus dem Nichts, in German. So I had Angela Sommerräder on. I saw the film in Graz, and unfortunately I missed you. So you were also in Graz a couple of days later, and I didn't make it to the second screening of the film. Otherwise, we could have met in Graz. And I wonder, how did you get in touch with Angela? I mean, how did this all come about? Because you're featured in the film quite prominently, along with Tewari, Paramahamsa Tewari.
Yes, and that was a complete surprise to me. I, of course, started the Tewari website back in 1997. And Angela, as you know, was researching Carl Schapeller.
Yeah.
And as she more she researched, and the more she found this worldwide web of information about all of these guys that have done all these different things and had the vision of being able to get out of the 1800s and into the 21st century with a new energy technology. And she came across the Tewari website, and my contact information was there. And I had an address there because I didn't want my phone on there just because I had too many phone calls, not enough time, right? So one day a letter appeared in the mail from Angela, and she described what she wanted to do. And so she had an email address there. And so I emailed her back, and I told her how to get in touch with Tewari. And I didn't hear anything for quite some time. About a year later, she emailed me and said, "Can you meet me in India in 3 weeks?" And I said, "Okay, let's do that."
Right.
So we met in the airport in some Middle Eastern country, and here she came with her crew and all this equipment and carts of sound gear and cameras, and off we went to India. And she had asked me to basically interview Tewari so that she could record his responses during the interview. And we also took a trip over the mountain to the other side of away from the coast, and went to the town where one of his machines had been built by a second party. They had built his machine in a factory that makes motors and generators. So that was to back up. That's how I got involved with the film. Was we filmed for 3 days, Mr. Tewari in the machine and at the factory, and then they wanted to get some input from me, so they brought me down to a beach and they filmed for a couple hours. And we asked her, "Well, when's the movie coming out?" She said, "Well, maybe if we're lucky, in about a year, we can get it in a festival." And it was accepted at Viennale, and we went and saw it there with the premiere. And I had no idea that I was going to have the role in the movie that it turned out to be. Just one of those things that happens. People tell me that my role in the movie turned out to be that I could kind of tie the whole concept together for the movie, and I guess that's how it happened.
Yeah, I think it's a fantastic movie. What do you think about it?
It is, because it has the, as we see today, it has the archetypical inventor. Okay, Carl Schappeler. There are many Carl Schappelers in many countries and many lands.
Yeah.
Trying to build something that nobody's built before. And in the end, he was not successful. And none of them have been successful so far. But for me, that was the interesting, one of the interesting parts of the movie, is that he so typifies what's gone on for the last 100 years. And then the stroke of luck or genius, both, is that Engele was able to tie that to two individuals that have cracked the code, so to speak. Professor Turter and Paramahamsa Tewari.
Yeah.
So it basically starts off Schappeler's understanding, trying to get something out of the void. And then finally, Tewari's put the physics together and the circuits together to be able to do it on a very large and massive scale. His machine can produce kilowatts. It could be scaled up to make megawatts. So the interesting part of the movie, The Void, comes from Tewari's space vortex theory, which I believe revolutionizes the concept of physics. The void itself is the only place where there is nothing. And according to his space vortex theory, the only place there is nothing is inside the electron. The electron is formed from the ether, as described by Tesla. And Tesla used Sanskrit to do that. We can back up and talk about that a little later. But the void is, If you consider a bubble floating in water, between the water and no water is a spherical surface. And that spherical surface in the ether is what is the electron. So outside of that surface, filling all space, is Akash, the ether, and inside is nothing, is the void. So a lot of discussions were held during the time that we filmed with Tewari, and I think it was a stroke of genius that she came up, that Engele came up with that title, Out of the Void.
So that was inspired by Tewari's work and, yes, and his theory that we will discuss a bit later on. Now, the show is called Tesla's Prophecy, and he prophesied in a lecture that he gave in 1892, I think, "Ere in many generations pass, our machinery will be driven by a power obtainable at any point in the universe," which is quite a remarkable statement to make, especially in that time. Now, how did you get in touch with Tesla and with this whole free alternative energy thing? What got you involved originally?
What involved me originally? I suppose it was actually, I was going down that path ever since I was a kid, reading articles about unexplained technologies or unexplained events. So I was kind of always interested in the what would you call the not normal physics, what might be called the paranormal. And I had gone through college as an electrical engineer and never heard the word Tesla described once. So nobody knew what Tesla was or who he was. All we knew, there was a magnetic field strength associated with the word Tesla. Well, about 1980, when some friends of mine started working with Minkowski multiple wave oscillator, we started building Tesla coils. And I thought to myself, well, how does this thing work? How does this Tesla coil circuit work? And I went to look it up, and I couldn't find any information anywhere. The only place you could find information was in the back of popular science magazines, where you could clip out a coupon and send away for information about how to build a Tesla coil. So I eventually got the idea, well, if nobody knows anything about Tesla and there aren't any Tesla coil books out there, and there really aren't many books about them, let's organize a conference. So that's basically why I organized the 1984 Tesla Centennial Symposium Conference with Elizabeth Rauscher. But before that, I'd read the book, Man Out of Time by Margaret Cheney, and it's still one of the best books about Tesla on the market. And on the back cover of the book, I saw that Tesla was using Sanskrit to describe how the universe worked, prana, aktikaman, akash. And I guess my interest was immediately piqued by that, because I had studied yoga since I'd had a spinal fusion when I was 24. And somebody mentioned, why don't you try yoga to help your back and your back pain? So I started studying Hatha yoga, and I started studying Eastern philosophy, and read the Tao of Physics and many other books, and became more and more interested in Hindu philosophy. I took a couple of courses in Sanskrit. And I still didn't know why Tesla had used Sanskrit to describe reality, until I found, in the late 80s, I found that Swami Vivekananda had come to this country to teach Vedic principles and Vedic science. He was the first yogi to come to the United States. And Tesla used to go to his lectures in New York City and became familiar with Sanskrit terminology. Now, this is a hypothesis on my part, I suppose I should say, but Tesla was walking through a park in Budapest at sunset, and he had described a vision that he had, which I take to be a mystic vision. He had a sort of a Zazen moment in which he saw how the universe worked. He saw all the fields, I guess, and saw the nature of the ether and how matter formed from the ether. And that's why when he came upon Vivekananda's work, he was actually given the words to describe how matter manifests from the ether. Before that, he didn't really have the terminology to describe it. But I think the most interesting thing is that Tesla described it, and a man named Walter Russell, who was a painter and a sculptor, drew it. He drew a picture of the wave of creation. And then Tiwari put the equations together to describe how it works and describe the mathematics behind the formation of the electron from the ether. So Tiwari's books and papers are available at tiwari.org. And
it's linked up, so I link that one to the website up from the start page right now, and then later then in the archive, if you go to the show, the link is there.
Good, yes, and I have just turned that over now. Tiwari's son, Anupam Tiwari, is handling that web page, and the contact for Anupam Tiwari is on that web page. So I guess that's how I got involved, from Tesla through Sanskrit to Tiwari. And then, reading back in the early, back in those days, things went by ditto machines. We sent each other copies of papers in the mail, And then the fax machine was invented, and then we were able to fax these things around. And you went to the back of the popular science magazines or Mechanics Illustrated, and you could find, you know, advertisements by the Tesla Bookstore or Borderland Science Research Corporation. And there were just a few repositories of this knowledge in the country. And so this information began to spread out of those old bookstores, Tesla Book Company and Borderland Science. And that's how that information was propagated through the 70s and 80s, and, you know, my source of the information back then. So it was just kind of a long path to get to, but here we are looking at what we call it Tesla's prophecy, is because he said, ere many generations pass, mankind will be able to attach his machines to the very real works of nature. And I believe that Tewari has done that. And this is Tesla's prophecy. These machines are real, and they are measurable, and they need to be funded to get into production.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I did a couple of shows on Tesla. He's one of the big subjects on this show, but I never heard about the fact that he was, so to say, into Vedic knowledge and into prana and all of those concepts, and that he was, so to say, taught by this yogi, and he attended lessons in New York. Oh, lessons, I mean talks of this yogi in New York, yeah?
Yes, exactly.
Mm-hmm. And that's, of course, an ideal bridge to Tewari, who is Indian, who also studied the Vedic tradition, apparently, and the Western scientific tradition, and what a perfect match. Now, someone also addressed this already in the chat, so we got this chat running here, and then people can post questions. So in his later years, which are the really interesting ones, I mean, the things we know about Tesla, he invented, until 1900 or something like that, alternate current and all of these things. And I think alternate current, this concept, is also something that came to him in this walk in this park in Budapest. And by the way, he was also studying in Graz for 2 years. And he loved the Schlossberg, which I can totally understand. In his later years, Tesla was living in a hotel in the last 10 years of his life, in his hotel in New Yorker. And Walter Baumgartner, was a man who interviewed Tesla every Sunday afternoon, and who tried to, I mean, what was going on there? I mean, Walter Baumgartner, that's what you told me.
No, it was Ralph Bergstresser.
Oh, I'm sorry. Then that was Ralph Bergstresser. Bergstresser.
Yes.
Okay. German Ralph, name.
Yes. Yes. That's why, you know, I really loved Austria and being able to go to, I call it the land of my ancestors, you know, that the German tribes, you know, what did our ancestors and our ancient ones know? That's all kind of been lost. But, you know, I'm half German, half Irish. So, at any rate, Ralph was an employee of David Sarnoff. And David Sarnoff was the head of, I believe he was the head of RCA. And the research laboratories that he founded became quite famous during those times. And Ralph worked for Sarnoff. And one of the things that he did was he was involved in a project to make the first portable radio. And it was basically a small box with vacuum tubes in it powered by a battery. And they handed these things out at the World's Fair. This was, you know, pre-1940. Well, once the war started, Ralph joined the Army. And towards the end of Tesla's life, Tesla had offered all of the patents and all the information he had to the war effort, to the War Department. So, long story short, Ralph got the order to go over and meet Tesla and review all his documents and all his papers. That led to a number of things. What Ralph told me, he was living in Phoenix, Arizona at the time, was that they would go over every Sunday afternoon and go through the papers. And then one Monday morning, Ralph got a call from Zito, who was Tesla's longtime assistant, telling him that Tesla had passed away during the night. So that was the first that he heard it was from Tesla's assistant. But the interesting thing about Ralph's working there is that Andrea Pujarric, remember him from the 1984 Tesla Centennial Symposium. When he showed up at the Tesla Centennial Symposium, he handed me some old documents that he said were drawings that were printed off of a very brittle microfiche. And these documents were a patent application for a particle beam weapon. And I read them, and it sounded just like Tesla. He had told me at the time when he gave them to me that this was Tesla's particle beam weapon, his death ray, that's been described in the literature back in the time, and also that Tesla talked about, that he'd invented this thing. So we didn't know for sure that this was Tesla's actual patent application, but when I read it, it sounded just like Tesla talked in all his other patents. So I decided we should print it in the 1984 proceedings, and we did, and not knowing for sure if it was really Tesla's work or not. About 5 years later, I was sent copies of the same paperwork with the stamp of the Nikola Tesla Museum Library. Some researcher had been to that library and actually made copies of what they had on file there, this patent application, and it turned out to be the same patent that we had published in the proceedings. So that's kind of the story of the particle beam weapon design and how it got published in the proceedings.
Okay, and no idea how I got to the name Walter Baumgartner then. But anyway, so this guy, Bergstrasser, you said.
Yes, Bergstrasser, yeah.
So he was with Tesla in the last period of his life, and he, so to say, sucked up all this knowledge, or I guess that was the point, being with Tesla every Sunday afternoon.
Right, right.
Yeah. And it's, but some people in the chat also ask, why did Tesla turn this over to the War Department? Wasn't he worried that it might cause some trouble for the world if he gives such a powerful weapon into the hands of the military?
Well, he wanted to do everything. Tesla was very patriotic, had become a citizen, I guess, and he was very patriotic, and he wanted to stop the Nazi menace, and all so. Right. He said, hey, anything you guys can use,
okay,
Here's my stuff. Basically is how I would interpret
it. Okay, so this was because of the war in Europe and of Hitler basically also threatening the United States at some point, that he said, okay, that's it. I'm going to turn it all over to the military.
Right, and my information is that the military did do some work on that at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in the early 50s. They looked at this weapon, and when I worked in aerospace, I took the design, because I worked in a test chamber that had vacuum chambers large enough to test the Skylab, and so there were a lot of vacuum experts there, how to generate a vacuum and how to make it as much of a vacuum as you have in deep space. It's quite a feat to be able to pump out all the molecules. So I gave it to one of the guys in the lab who was a vacuum expert, and I said, here's Tesla's particle beam weapon design. It basically consists of a high voltage device inside a spherical chamber, but the spherical chamber has a little tiny hole in it, and so you could describe it as an open-ended vacuum tube, because he would pump this vacuum down, and then he would ionize a tungsten element, and he proposed to accelerate the tungsten atoms out one side of the vacuum tube and propel them into the atmosphere and have them burn a hole through the atmosphere as they went to hit a target. That was the concept, was to shoot an ionized beam of tungsten atoms through the atmosphere and land it on a target so that it would heat and blow up the target. And so apparently that had been looked at. And I even submitted it to a DARPA, Defense Advanced Projects Research Agency, was going around every year and asking for ideas on how to make different weapon systems. So I said, what the heck, I'll just submit it to these guys. So I wrote it up and submitted an open-ended vacuum chamber for making a particle beam. And off it went to DARPA. And I didn't hear anything back. After about 6 months, I called up the contact and I said, hey, what about that open-ended vacuum tube? And he said, well, we haven't quite figured out what to do with that yet. But that was the last I ever heard of it. It probably is not a practical device. It might work. It might have some effect, but probably not practical.
Okay, but they allegedly tried this out in the 50s anyway.
Well, they worked on it. Allegedly, they worked on the concept.
Puharik, is this the Puharik that also wrote the book on Uri Geller, yeah? Called
yes,
Uri.
Really, oh, yeah, and he wrote about the mushrooms, the magic mushrooms, and he did a lot of psychic research. Yes.
Very interesting. I wonder how all of those things go together. I mean, yeah.
Well, you know, these guys back in the late 40s, early 50s, very small group of guys, and I think that Bergstresser also knew T. Henry Moray, and you know, Bill Bice was involved in this.
Was Townsend Brown also involved in this group?
No, never got a whiff that Townsend Brown knew these guys. But you see, Bergstresser, you know, T. Henry Moray had supposedly built a machine that had about a 50 kW output, vacuum tube driven. May have had some radioactive elements in the tubes, but he knew Bergstresser. They worked together at the same aerospace company for a while. And T. Henry Moray told Bergstresser that he could never get the capacitor stable enough to make the device work for very long. So that's kind of the only history I have on that.
Which device do you?
It was T. Henry Moray's device. He made a very, you know, there's a book about it, and then his son has tried to since generate money to do research on it, but nobody's ever been able to recreate it.
And what was this device supposed to do?
It put out power, about 50,000 watts of power.
Oh boy. Okay.
It was a series of radio tubes inside a big box.
All right. So it was an energy generator.
Yeah, if people Google the sea of energy in which the Earth floats, that's a book that T. Henry Moray wrote about the ether and about the work that he had done trying to make this device work.
Now, when Tesla died, the Navy came in and picked up all his stuff.
Yeah, they picked it up and they sent it to back to Yugoslavia to the museum. You know, they're. I think this is a good time to talk about conspiracy theories.
And yeah, I mean, people normally say, well, they just picked up all the good stuff and, yeah, they sent the bad stuff or the not-so-interesting stuff to Yugoslavia, and then they built all those advanced technology in, I don't know, Area 51. So that's basically, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what do you think about this whole story, especially after his death? How did those things develop?
My personal opinion is that they basically sent it all back to Yugoslavia. I mean, they came in and they copied it probably and looked it over, but there was nothing there that they didn't already know about or that they could use, in my opinion.
Because Tesla already contacted them in the early 40s, yeah?
Yeah, that's the point, exactly.
Or before that, yeah.
Yeah, they had all that information. They knew what he had.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the other theory is that Tesla was murdered, and I don't believe that either. Another theory is, If he had, we talked about this a little bit before, you know, there's the story about this car. He had a Pierce Arrow car, and he had a box that he put in the car, and he drove around with it.
Yeah, that's maybe one of the most famous stories about Tesla, his Pierce Arrow and the free energy generator that he...
Right. The first time I ever saw that was somebody sent a copy that had been copied of a copy of a copy of a copy of a dittoed, you know, write-up. Supposedly written by this nephew, and it's very brief, and nobody's ever found the car, and nobody's ever found any evidence that this ever happened. So I pretty much discount it. I don't think it ever happened. It could have happened. If it did happen, here's the catch. Why would Tesla, having seen what mankind did with 60 cycle 50 cycle alternating current generators and motors, look what they did to the planet with the motor and the generator. Why would he give mankind free energy?
Well, I don't know, because we would stop polluting the planet.
Well, on the other hand, we'd cut down the rainforest by next year if we didn't have to put gasoline in the chainsaws.
Well, but you could ask the same question about Tiwari. I mean, what happens if he comes out with his invention? But well, anyway, that's yeah, for later on.
There's just take this down in case we don't forget. There's something called Jevons paradox, J-E-A-V-I-N-S. Jevons paradox was written by a guy in the 1800s that noticed that during the Industrial Revolution, every time somebody came up with an advance in efficiency, you had increased population and increased resource depletion. So. That's you know, the double-edged sword of the free energy thing is that we're going to make things better or worse.
To stay a little bit with the conspiracies, someone asks, and these are the typical questions, of course, what mind energy weapons are real, I guess he means, but not yet talked about in public media? Weapons he knows are possible, but we are not aware about. So are there any other weapons apart from the particle beam weapon that would, you know, use maybe ELF waves to confuse us or to, you know, is anything along those lines that...
Not that I know of, not that I've had direct contact with, but if you look at the work of Tom Bearden, he has written extensively on the possibility of what he calls scalar weapons, and these are weapons that can be directed from space and cause havoc. I think that if any of these weapon systems exist, the guys that make the decisions have just funded the big bombs. I know that there may be space-based weapon, laser weapons and particle beam weapons, space-based, that I'd have no doubt of. But, you know, as far as the exotic technologies, I don't have any proof of it. Tom Bearden and the people that work on along his lines, I think if your readers look him up, you'll find that there are, theoretically, all these other types of weapon systems that could be directed beam weapon systems based on what they call scalar wave technology. But I don't have direct evidence of that.
Okay, so apart from directed energy beam weapons, you think there might be other concepts based on scalar energy that could also be weaponized?
Yeah, and of course then there's the old HARP project.
HARP.
Yeah, I mean, I listened to the guy. I've got a recording of the inventor talking about it. And if you focus multiple gigawatts of energy on a particular part of the lower ionosphere, you possibly can influence the jet stream and start to move the jet stream around and change the weather. So, you know, the Navy and University of Alaska denies all this, but it's in the patent, and I have him on tape on National Public Radio talking about how that's a possible use for the HARP machine. But that's all standard electromagnetics. That's just focusing microwaves at a certain region in the atmosphere.
And also leveraging certain effects that amplify this. Isn't that also, yeah?
Yeah.
Okay, but HARP, was HARP based on some original Tesla inventions?
No, nothing to do with Tesla whatsoever.
Yeah.
I think the oil company, if it was Conoco or Mobil, I forget which, they found this huge deposit resource base up in, where is it, in Alaska. There was this huge oil field they found up there, gas field, natural gas, but they didn't have any way to get it to market because it was so remote. So they went to this physicist and they asked him, "What can you come up with a way we could use this natural gas?" And so he came, what he said was, "Well, you build a bunch of gas-fired turbines up there for generators, and you use electrical generation systems to run your microwave transmitters, and then you focus it at the bottom of the ionosphere." And, you know, he's got a 20-page patent that describes how to do this. They had, you know, nothing whatsoever to do with Tesla.
Okay, so, and nothing with free energy, of course, because
they came up with a way to sell natural gas to the Department of Defense to do research.
Oh, that's interesting. So the reason why HARP is in this area is because it's close to those gas fields?
Yeah, it is on those gas fields.
It's on those gas fields, okay. I never heard that. Yeah.
Yeah, and they didn't have any way to use it and get it to market, but they developed a market for it once he had the patent, and the DOD bought into it, and voila, cash flow.
But is HARP still in operation? Because allegedly it has been shut down two years ago.
Right, that's what I read. It's been shut down. Who knows if there's other ones? People say there are other facilities operating, and I don't know that for sure. I haven't kept track of it. I mean, these things are not easy to hide.
There's one in Norway, I think, and the Russians have one.
Yeah, mm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What about those stories flying around that HARP could influence the behavior of large populations?
I don't see how it could, because it's a directed beam approach.
I think what they say is it's reflected from the ionosphere and then focused on some remote country . So you didn't hear anything about that?
No, but I think that would be very hard to do given weather patterns. The variability and the rapid change in weather. You know, if you were able to reflect something down on somebody, you know, you'd have a very small window to do it because the weather's going to change.
Okay. But why would the weather influence that?
Well, as the ionosphere breathes, so to speak, as the fronts move, the layers that you reflect off move. That's why you can pick up stations at nighttime through the ionosphere bounce as the signals bounce around that you can't pick up during the day. Just the way that shortwave radio works is an example of how that all changes between night and day, and it changes with the weather as well.
All right. I mean, people, of course, they ask, well, how would you know that? But, well, the point is, you just haven't heard about any of those applications, so.
No, I don't. And I think if there are nefarious programs going on to do all of this, once again, I'm not a conspiracy theorist, although I love to listen to them.
They're fun sometimes, aren't they?
Yeah, I think the best one is what they're doing to the atmosphere, the chemtrails. So I have a friend that's got a PhD in nuclear engineering from MIT and spent 40 years in classified programs in Lockheed, and he studied chemtrails for many years, and his conclusion was, well, something's going on, but I don't know what it is.
So I would say that's also, I did some shows on this issue, but I eventually gave it up because, well, there is nothing new really coming out. I mean, you have a lot of claims flying around. You have, I mean, you can watch them. You can see those vapor trails developing into cloud systems, and that's just happening. But if you then Google vapor trails and you look it up in Wikipedia, that's how they now describe those vapor trails. They didn't do so 10 years ago or 15 years ago when I did the first show on this subject, interestingly enough. but that's how it's described now. And you run against a stone wall if you cover the subject, don't you?
Yes, I know. Back around the mid-90s, I was living in northwest Colorado, a fairly remote area, and one day I looked up and the sky was crisscrossed like a plaid blanket with these trails, you know, at right angles to each other. I took a picture of it somewhere in my old paper photographs. I've got pictures of the most incredible patchwork of trails in the middle of nowhere that you could ever imagine. So what was going on? I have no idea.
Yeah. Well, that's a really strange, and then of course there are theories that bring together HARP and chemtrails. So have you heard of those?
Oh no, I haven't. Tell me.
Oh God, yeah. I mean, I think the basic idea is that the Welsbach patent. Have you heard about the Welsbach patent?
No.
Welsbach particles, where they bring up aluminium, barium, and something else. I forgot. They put it into the atmosphere and they increase the conductivity of the atmosphere, and then they go in with HARP and use this conductivity to do something.
Yeah, I have heard that, yes, because they can simulate it. Well, here, let me propose this to your audience. Just because the military is doing it in secret doesn't mean it's bad.
Well, maybe, that's a good question.
Maybe,
yeah.
You know, maybe these guys have found something and they're trying to figure out how to counteract something else. You know, maybe this is a defensive system. Maybe they've figured out that, hey, the Great Plains of the United States are going to dry up and it's going to become a desert. And if we don't figure out how to keep the rainfall coming over this continent, a lot of people are going to starve. So maybe they're doing some kind of weather modification research. Who knows? I just tell people, just because the military is doing it doesn't necessarily mean it's bad. Just because it's classified doesn't mean it's bad. Now, you and I would like to not have the classification. We'd like to know what's going on.
Oh, yeah.
So here's something I noticed. This was back when Fukushima hit. Was HARP still running during Fukushima?
I think so, wasn't it? I mean, 2013, I think it was.
Yeah,
because... No, not 2013, 2010. Fukushima was 2010. I think it was... Oh, when was Fukushima? Well, a couple of years ago. I think it was still running.
Because when I saw the modeling of the radiation trails, they were modeling the radiation trails, and this big, massive radiation cloud was going across the Pacific, and it was headed, arching up and headed for the jet stream to become down across the United States. So it would have dumped all of that radiation on the United States. But just about the time that massive cloud of radiation got within range of where they could focus that HARP heater, that entire cloud diverged and part went north and part went south, and most of it went away from the United States. The end result was, it looked like that the jet stream came down across the East Coast where it had never really been before and caused massive thunderstorms and tornadoes in places that they never had massive thunderstorms and tornadoes like they had at that time. So my theory was, well, maybe if there is a HARP weapon existing, maybe they used it to steer their radiation cloud away from the continent.
Okay, yeah, that would be then an example of a good application.
Yeah.
Unless they steered it towards someone else. That would be
bad
then.
Right. It went towards you guys.
Towards us, yeah. Great. Wonderful.
Right.
Anyway, I mean, yeah, we won't get to the bottom of this anyway, but yeah, there are a lot of theories hanging around there. And by the way, people also blame the drought on chemtrails. So, you know. And there's a theory that chemtrails are so to say preserving or helping us against the ozone, the hole in the ozone layer, and reflecting radiation. I mean, there are all kinds of theories. And the problem is, at some point, I mean, you just have to say, well, if we don't get any information, and if you're also, I mean, it chemtrails is a good example for a toxic subject. I mean, we had, I don't, you probably haven't heard about this, but there's a very right-wing party in Austria, and those guys are the only ones who were questioning the parliament about chemtrails. And of course, immediately you are then in, you know, you are a right-wing if you talk about chemtrails. That's how those things evolved here.
Yeah, the same is true here as well.
Oh, yeah. Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, I think you're, you know, it used to be us, that's what us New Agers, us, you know, we're on the fringes, the people that were investigating UFOs and psychic phenomenon and yoga and consciousness.
UFOs and yoga, that's an interesting combination, yeah.
All these, well, when I went, on that trip around the world that I took, I spoke to all these inventors, maybe 25 inventors, and when you're talking about their subjects, their subject matter, most of them are engineers or physicists, some PhDs, and you sit down and you start talking to them about free energy and space and ether theory, and within a half an hour, I'll guarantee you, you'll be talking about Atlantis and UFOs and psychic phenomenon and on and on and on.
Yeah, no, there's a straight line to that. I don't know why, but there is.
Straight line. So in the meantime, the right-wing guys, while they kind of poo-pooed all this stuff, somewhere along the line they got into nutrition and the fact that the food supply was poisoned and the fluorine in the water and the GMOs and all of that. And the more they dug deeper into conspiracy theories, they found all these other things. And they're very, very vocal about it. And so because they're very politically active, that's part of their dialogue. I think that what the progressive left, you know, the people that have studied this all these years, we haven't been as radically politically active, so we didn't carry that with us into politics.
Well, that's a problem, isn't it? Because the left is poo-pooing those subjects. Big time.
It
breaks my heart.
One of the best progressive left magazines in this country is Mother Jones Magazine, but they poo-pooed fluoridated water and they denigrate people that are concerned about vaccines, and so you know this so-called scientifically educated people, a lot of them are. I think it goes up against their inability to look beyond the current state of physics. And, you know, physics hasn't given us anything new, really, in my opinion, since the 1800s, because all of our energy conversion technologies are 19th century.
Yeah.
And we're in the 21st century. The fuel cell, steam engines, steam turbines, solar cells, that was all invented in the 1800s.
Yeah, so early 1900s, quantum physics, and that's it, yeah.
Well, yeah, what have physicists done for us? And, you know, when we try to tell them you can't have over-unity, they immediately knee-jerk to the second law of thermodynamics, not knowing that the second law of thermodynamics needs to be modified to take into account that space is not empty, which they've taught for 100 years that space was empty.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, just coming back for a second to the way those kind of subjects are treated by the left and by the so-called right. It's interesting, it's kind of stuck there. I mean, the arguments, they fly back and forth, and the discussions, they're stuck, and then you are immediately, you know, so to say, pushed into this right sector of the political spectrum, which me and many others don't want to be in at all, and many people then shy away from that, and that's a real pity. I mean, I think there are a lot of people who won't touch that, because they're afraid to be, you know, associated with certain elements. And that's really, I think this is a problem.
It is. It's the madmen, the people, you know, that is a popular TV show, I guess. I've never really seen it, about the advertising industry. And they've been able to use and manipulate the public to keep us divided, so that the people that started off in the health food industry in the 10s and 20s and 30s and 40s that built the health food industry based on natural hygiene, what evolved into, you know, where granola came from. I mean, granola got popular after the hippies discovered it during Woodstock, but really it came from, you know, the people in the 20s and 30s invented it. So that group of natural hygienists that were opposed to the vaccinations, they were opposed to the fluoridation, you know, they all got relegated by the press and by the companies that were making the fluoridation systems to be thought of as kooks. And so the established power brokers are very skilled at turning people not only against each other, but turning public opinion into thinking that if a guy saw a UFO, he must be crazy. But we all know that there are so many people and so many credentials that have seen it. It's something that should be investigated.
And the problem is that it is, when it's poo-pooed, I mean, there are a lot of subjects. I mean, you must be skeptical, in my opinion. You have to be skeptical, especially, okay, if you talk about UFOs and stuff like that, and, I don't know, alien abductions and what have you. Of course you have to be skeptical. But the problem then is that things get turned down with absolutely false arguments. And I'm not saying that all of those things are true. I mean, in fact, I hope they're not all true, because that would be just, I mean, horrendous. But, I mean, there isn't a real discussion taking part, and the arguments against a lot of things, okay, are also against some aspects of chemtrails. I mean, yeah, there are people out there who are just nuts, and they talk just a lot of bullshit. But there are other things out there that need to be investigated, but it's not happening. And it's as you say, I don't know. I mean, is that a conspiracy in your opinion? I mean, is the media in this big conspiracy? What's going on here?
Well, I think in many cases it is a conspiracy by, for instance, the way that the whole subject of invading Iraq in this country was done. I mean, it was a total manipulation. I mean, I knew he didn't have weapons of mass destruction because I, you know, listened to the news for the previous 15 years. So, but the public can be very easily manipulated. I think the thing to do is to tell people, just relax. Look, you're never going to figure out who brought down the Twin Towers at 9/11. You know, you're never going to figure out who killed Kennedy. You know, they're just not going to tell you that. And, you know, you can spend your life trying to figure this out, but just relax and realize where you are in history. We are in two places in history. First of all, we're leaving the age of Pisces and we're going into the age of Aquarius. And there was a very famous song, as you know, written about, this is the dawning of the age of Aquarius.
Yeah.
Second of all, if you look at the prophecies of indigenous peoples all around the world, they all refer to this time as being a time of great change. And you don't have to be a prophet to see that this is going to be a time of great change.
Well, there are a lot of people, I mean, they are denying that we are in a time of great change, which I think is really funny, actually, because, I mean, you just have to listen to the news at any day. And, I mean, it's just something, a lot of things are changing anyway, but not always to the better. Well, rarely to the better.
Well, you know, it's cyclical. Things go in cycles. So in yoga, they talk about the four ages of for a certain number of years, and the yugas, what they call the yugas, and the Kali Yuga is the age of darkness which we're in, and there are even cycles within cycles. So you see, if you look around the world, that empires collapse and they don't last forever, and then people rebuild from the ashes. And to me, it seems like that this system we're working under right now is not sustainable. It's going to come apart, and then we're going to rebuild from the ashes.
Well,
with free energy, Jim.
Let's see. I hope you're wrong, but who knows? Now, Tesla talked about this energy form that is available anywhere, and that we actually should be using right now. Well, was he wrong, or what happened?
Rephrase that again.
Tesla talked about this energy that is available at every point in space, and we should be using right now because, some generations have passed since 1892, and we're still using coal and gas and oil for the most part. So was he wrong? I mean, what was his theory? I mean, why did he say that in the first place? And what was he exactly talking about? Do you know what he was talking about? What was he talking about? Some kind of free energy, or was he talking about energy transmission?
He was talking about free energy. I think he gave up on the energy transmission because it wasn't practical. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's another conspiracy theory that J.P. Morgan, you know, shut down his project at Wardenclyffe when he was doing the wireless transmission of power experiments. But in the book My Invention, he's which was written in the late 1800s, early 1900s. No, it was written in, early 1900s. He stated that J.P. Morgan was his friend, and J.P. Morgan did not destroy the Wardenclyffe Tower project. So that's a conspiracy theory that needs to be put to bed, is that his wireless transmission of power system, I believe, was abandoned because he realized it wasn't practical. Now, I also think that when we talk about Tesla's prophecy, ere many generations pass, he knew it because he saw it, but he didn't ever figure out how to do it. Tiwari was the first one to figure out how to do it. If he'd have figured out how to do it, he'd have patented it. He'd have put it on paper and he'd have built it.
Okay, so just to be clear on that, you don't think that Tesla ever built a free energy generator or a space energy generator?
No.
Okay.
I don't see any evidence of it. And people that have studied his work longer than I have gone back into the archives. Historians that I have known have not come up with anything that suggests that he ever did that. There are so many people on the internet. The internet has increased the disinformation 10,000 fold.
In every direction.
You know, people don't want to read a book or read the patents. They go to the web page and they read the stuff some guy wrote, and that's a gospel to them.
Yeah. Well, because it tells them what they want to hear. I mean, I noticed from this show, so if people make statements like you did now, people get upset. They say, oh, he's a disinformant. And I mean, okay, I mean, that's your opinion. And certainly there is no evidence that he ever did that, but he talked about it, and that's an interesting take. So you think that in his epiphany, and I mean, he was a genius guy, there's no question about that. He was one of the greatest genius of the 20th century in essence, and he imagined and built the 20th century as we know it today. I mean, he even thought about things like pre-runner of the internet and stuff like that. But anyway, so you say he didn't really build anything that would use space energy, but he saw that, maybe in his vision that he had in Budapest, yeah?
Yes, yeah. He realized that it could be done.
That's interesting, because allegedly Tesla also built machines in his head, and he started them, and they were running in his imagination, and then when they were breaking, he fixed them, and then when they were running perfectly, he would just draw up one blueprint, and that would be it. So, So I mean, he was really an interesting guy, and so you think also in this, so he had a lot of abilities intellectually, it's quite possible that he understood electrons and matter at a level that normal people can't imagine, but he couldn't engineer it yet.
Right, right.
Fascinating, okay. He was also in contact with Walter Russell, and he told Walter Russell, we touched on him briefly, and there's a show in the archive about him. But so he was a famous artist and basically someone who was investigating all kinds of stuff. And Tesla told Russell that he should bury his findings at the Smithsonian Museum for 1,000 years. I mean, what on earth did Russell uncover?
Well, that's a good question, because I spent about 5 or 6 years working on that with the University of Science and Philosophy, which was what became a Russell's work. They had a mansion in a place called Swannanoa in the foothills of the Blue Ridge Mountains in Virginia, near the West Virginia border. And Russell had an epiphany that lasted a lot longer than Tesla's did. He had 20 plus days of Zazen. He wasn't eating. He was just drawing in his studio and making diagrams and making paintings and wouldn't talk to anybody. And the family got very concerned, what's wrong with this guy, you know, because he wasn't eating and he was just making all these geometrical designs and patterns. And they had a doctor come in and, you know, look him over and watch what he was doing. And the doctor said, well, he doesn't seem to be in bad health, so just leave him alone and see what happens. And eventually, Russell came out of that, and he'd written this book called The Universal One, which is basically his dissertation on how the universe works and fits together. And he came up with a very interesting periodic chart of the elements. And he came up with the idea that you would be able to do transmutation of elements using magnetic fields. So he spent some time doing that and claimed to have done it. And I worked with a team of people back then. There was a magazine called Fulcrum that was published by the University of Science and Philosophy. And maybe they've gotten those journals online now. But I put together a mass spectrometer and a UV Vis IR spectral photometer and basically set up a laboratory to try and duplicate what Russell had done. My conclusion at the end of a year's worth of investigation was that Russell had a tube leak, and what he reported as transmutation of elements was actually a leak from the atmosphere, you know, nitrogen leak into the gas tube he was experimenting with. But the other thing he did was I found the remnants of his experiment for his electro-optical dynamo generator. And he was
doing work into free energy as well, yeah?
Yes. He was making a machine that consisted of concentric coils shaped in a conical method. So they were like two cones coming together. And the whole idea is very similar to the pattern that you see on the Navajo Indian rug blanket, where you have two tornadoes coming together. So that's the vortex. Two vortexes coming together and two vortexes coming apart at the same time. Now, that vortex coming together is kind of what basically Tiwari talks about, how that forms from, how the electron forms from matter, and what Tesla called prana acting upon Akash forms that matter. And that was kind of Russell's same idea. As you take these concentric coils in a cone shape, and then you could make a free energy machine. And when I got to this was in about 92 or 3, I found the remnants of those coils in the basement of this mansion and really couldn't see how they would have operated. There was no mechanism that I could see to produce free energy, but he'd been winding. I mean, he put them together and he was trying to make a free energy machine as well. If we experimented with this concept of Russell's being able to transmute elements, but we never got it to work, obviously, or you would have heard about it. But it touches in that same area, the low energy nuclear change people talk about, which is that during certain physical processes, with this mostly seen during cold fusion work, elements turn up that weren't there when the experiment started. And how that works, you know, Tesla may have seen that this was something that needed to be locked up, but nobody's ever been able to figure out how to take Russell's drawings and Russell's ideas and turn them into hardware. So maybe it'll take 1,000 years before we figure out how to do that. So probably no need to lock that material up because nobody can figure out how to use it.
Sounds a bit like alchemy.
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
Yeah. Yeah. I got a show coming up with an alchemist, so I'm quite curious on that subject. It's. Well, all right. So Tesla and Russell knew each other, which is quite fascinating. I didn't know that. Now coming to the our times. Before we move on to Tiwari, which basically is the main subject of today, but we're already talking for 90 minutes. Can you believe it?
No. I was going to ask, were there any more questions coming in?
I'll put them in if I read something interesting at the moment. Nothing really, but are you aware of, well, you are aware of, obviously, of Klaus Turtu's work, but have you looked into it in more detail?
Yes, I read his paper. I mean, I didn't read his paper. I downloaded his paper and I went through it, but the math left me probably 35 years ago. It's very mathematical.
Yeah,
and I really need to look at it in more depth. It looks like an easy experiment to recreate. So, you know, my first inclination is to try and recreate the experiment.
You mean the one based on the electrostatic field, yeah?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. He shows in the movie, Out of the Void, he shows that spinning piece.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, the point is we are talking about very, very small forces here. And because obviously this thing is placed on water, and that's obviously to reduce the friction. And there is a very, very tiny current that can be measured. And basically, the bone of contention is that if there is a very tiny current, then this current is probably responsible to bring build up the energy to make this thing turn. But Tutor says, it's one magnitude smaller than the energy, the mechanical energy produced. And the problem here is, and I can understand that where I talk to physicians, is that, well, but it's very difficult to measure small currents. And this is really a very small current. So would you agree that that's a difficult thing to do?
Yes.
So see, and if he makes a tiny mistake, then yeah.
Yeah, small currents, femtoamp meters. We have, you know, the amount of current that we can measure goes down to femtoamps, but extremely difficult. You know, if you move your hand, you'll see a change in the current just because you've moved the ions in the atmosphere.
Exactly. So the argument is, or the critic is, well, he just didn't measure the current right, and if he would do a correct measurement, then he would find out that the power produced, so the current times the tension, the volts, is exactly the mechanical energy that he's looking at here. But yeah, I don't know. I didn't do the experiment, so I can't say it.
I appreciate this discussion because that triggers a. Something for me that may help explain his effect, and that is, I hadn't thought of this before we talked, so thank you. The one of the things I found about all these free energy devices is that anytime you have a plasma or you have an arc or a spark, you know, if it's glowing purple, any of these machines, I have a physics paper from standard physics that talks about how excess energy can be coupled into a system during an arc discharge. So the arc itself ionizes the air. Electrons become available, and those electrons are coupled into the current itself. So anytime you have a high voltage, you have the possibility of having more energy get into the circuit than you measured coming out of what is supplying the energy, because it's coupled in through the gas, through the electrons that are being ionized in the gas, whether it's in a plasma discharge tube or whether it's in open air. So that's a possibility. Maybe that's what's going on in this circuit, that it's being coupled from the external environment.
So that's where you think the extra energy is coming from? Couldn't measure? Well, okay, yeah. I don't know. I mean, the critics I heard is that he just didn't measure the current correctly because it's such a small current, and that it would all add up if he did it in a real expensive lab. So, but I don't know. I mean, I really want this to work. And then,
You bring up a good point, because that's the bugaboo of this whole subject or this whole field of endeavor, is that measurements are not easy. And, you know, I'm learning all the time and about how to measure things. And if you've got a guy that's got something going around in circles on a YouTube video and it's got sparks or it's glowing purple or it's a plasma, you need an incredibly expensive amount of equipment to really test that machine and figure out what's going on. And it could take you months to test it.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing is that he, Tutu, also has a machine then based on the magnetic field, other than the electric field that this little thingy is based on that you see in Angela's film. And I really took the time and thought this through. I think I understood it. And in my opinion, it should work. This thing has to make 270,000 spins per minute, and that's very difficult to build again, and he couldn't build it yet. But that would be so interesting to see if that would work.
Well, I haven't seen the information on that device.
Yeah, it's basically what you see in the film is free energy device based on the electric field. But
right.
the output is very small, and you can scale it up, he claims. But still, it wouldn't do anything, maybe 100 watt or something like that. But if you base it on the magnetic field, then you could make like kilowatts in a one square meter. But this thing would have to spin at an incredible speed, about 10% of the speed of light it would need to reach. I mean, in the radial speed. I mean, it's difficult to talk about these things in English. I'm not used to. But anyway, so, and that's difficult to build. He doesn't have the money for that. And so he couldn't prove it yet. But I don't know. The Chinese offered him to build it, but he doesn't want to go to China with his family. I can understand that.
my wife has it. Where she works as a teacher that spent 2 years in China, and she now has all sorts of chest problems, and she's always getting colds, and just the breathing the air over there.
Of course, if you live in Beijing or something like that, that's really bad. Or anyway, but you didn't really look.
You know what? Just before I forget, when we were talking about the collapse of civilization, the thought occurred to me that, see, you live in Austria, so you might not notice it. I live in the United States, and, you know, the bridges are coming apart, the roads are coming apart. So I go to Austria, I didn't see any potholes, and I rode on trains going 130 miles an hour that are, like, floating on air, and they're silent, and it's like I am really... Just to let you know, and all your listeners, I am so impressed with Austrian engineering and the whole infrastructure in Austria. You're the envy of the world. I mean, it's compared to the United States, we're really going downhill. So, congratulations for being able to do things right.
But I think there are plans in America, in the US now to catch up. And I mean, the Chinese are doing it, so I guess the US will do it too. They have to. I mean, there is no other way around.
We don't know what's going to happen here.
Oh boy, yeah, no one knows, and there are some scary stories out there. Again, let's leave those conspiracies behind.
Yeah, okay.
But
let's move on.
Yeah, let's move on. So Klaus Turtow's work, I think it's interesting. I would love to see him doing his full test, but let's see if that ever happens. Now, you got in touch with Tiwari in
1984.
With Tiwari as well?
Oh, with Tiwari, yeah, I got in 1984.
All right. And he said something that's very interesting. So he says, we have erred though unknowingly, in our design of electrical generators and have remained in error for more than two centuries. That's a really interesting thing to say. So what he's saying is, and I had another guest on, Markus Reid, probably haven't heard of him. He's probably one of those guys you would want to seek out and talk with, because he also built some working things where a LED is powered by his theory. And he basically also says that the way we build up our circuits, it's just the wrong way, and we are, so to say, killing it. And what Tiwari says here reminded me of that. So, it could be. I mean, it could be that we just did it the wrong way, because the first guy who did it, he just tried it out, and then people built on his things, and then we just ran off into the wrong direction. But can you explain what Tiwari means with that? How is it that the design of electrical generators are just wrong? I mean, they're working, obviously, but they could work better. That's what he's saying.
Yeah. The first electrical generator attributed to Faraday, and all subsequent generators until Tiwari, basically have a back torque or a reaction that works against the energy that's trying to make them turn. So in order to make a generator put out electrical energy, you have to spin it. And so you have to use something to turn it. And once you get that generator generating power, the electric energy that's generated creates fields, magnetic fields, that are in opposition to the prime mover, which is what we call the device that's turning it. So if the prime mover is a stream of water, a water wheel, or if the prime mover is an electric motor or a gas turbine, there is a reaction that slows down or opposes the force of the prime mover that's created when you generate power. And that's always been the case until Tiwari invented it. And so what Tiwari has done was he came up with a magnetic field path design.
So that's also related, to Lenz's law, yeah?
Yes.
So any current that is induced by a magnetic field will be running into a direction so that the resulting magnetic field will go against the inducing magnetic field.
Yeah? That's correct.
Yeah. Okay.
So Lenz's law is in effect in all of these generators, and it results in what we call back torque. It creates a torque that reacts against the driving torque.
Yep.
Yeah. So what Tiwari did was arrange the circuit paths so that this Lenz's law is canceled, and he now has applied for a U.S. patent and an international patent on this. But the net effect of this is that he has been able to build a device that the top measurement so far was 2.38 times more energy out than energy went in. So it's an over-unity machine. And basically he's saying up until his invention, these machines have not been designed correctly to take full advantage of the power that's available from the magnets.
Okay. And so what he did is he canceled this effect somehow.
Yes, he canceled the back torque. Okay. And so the way I like to describe this is that the Wright brothers took simple common materials and rearranged them into a shape that produced lift. Voila, the airplane.
And people were saying this is absolutely impossible. It's physically, theoretically impossible, even at the time when the Wright brothers were already flying. I have to stress that.
Yes, thank you. That's exactly right. Major physicists were saying, you know, basically the old argument, if a God had meant man to fly, he would have given him wings.
A physicist says that. That's really interesting.
So, I mean, the Wright brothers, 4 years after the Wright brothers, this is an important point here. A man just wrote a book about the history of the Wright brothers. And if you just grab me, let me grab that reference off the shelf here. He points out that 4 years after the Wright brothers flew, people were still coming to look at the airplane and then go back and they wrote negative reports. So it takes a long time for somebody to get the idea across that something new has been done.
Oh, yeah.
Even when they examine it, something that they're seeing, they claim it's a fraud even though they've seen it fly.
Isn't that interesting? That's really, and it's a psychological thing going on here.
Yeah, yes, and this electrical generator is much harder to measure than seeing an airplane fly. Yeah. So this is even more difficult. So the book is called The Wright Brothers, and it just came out last year, written by David McCullough. And it's a book about the Wright brothers and their work. But that was the interesting thing I found. I read a review of this book, and they pointed out that 4 years later, they were still trying to get funding. So here we have Tewari. What he has done, he's taken common materials, going back to that same theme, the common material theme. He's taken those common materials, and he's rearranged them in a manner that reduces the back torque and partially eliminates eliminates most of the effects of Lenz's law. So his machines now have a efficiency greater than one. And it's a very simple measurement. It's a sine wave input to a motor, and it's a sine wave output from the generator. And these are fairly easy to measure with not such high dollar equipment as you would need to measure some of these other devices. So it's a very simple measurement to be done. Power engineers can easily make this measurement. The factory that built a replica of Tewari's machine, where they make 3,000 motors and generators a month. You saw that in the movie, Out of the Void. They show this factory and they show the vice president of the company, a very large company in India. They show the site manager. They show the senior engineer.
That was a stroke of luck for Angela, because they really did this test on this day. That wasn't like made up for the film. It was really happening on that day, yeah?
Well, the day that we tested Tewari's machine and got over that 2.38, actually was Sai Baba's birthday, his guru's birthday. So, yeah, it was a stroke of luck that we got that good a result. And then we went over the mountain to the factory where they had also made this machine. And all those engineers, these are you have to realize, because I have my own doubts. You know, I have to say, well, am I really measuring this correctly? Am I doing the right job? Am I doing a good job? You know, this is my reputation as an engineer. You know, and then if I'm wrong, so what? I'm wrong. I could admit I'm wrong. But am I actually seeing what I think I'm seeing? So I go and I meet these engineers, and these are power engineers that live, breathe, and eat daily generators. They build them. They design them. They're the best engineers that India has to offer. They graduated from esteemed universities. And they're saying the same thing. It's over unity. They made the measurement. It's over unity. It confirms all the other people, including myself, that made the measurement. So we have to say, yes, this is over Unity. It's replicable. It can be easily assembled in any factory. Now, how do we get funding to get it there?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, one would think, if this is really working, really, really working, why is there even a question about getting funding? I mean, that's ridiculous, isn't it?
Yeah, that's ridiculous.
But who knows? I mean, yeah.
That's, you know, finally I came across this article about the Wright brothers. And here are these guys, they've got this thing that goes up in the air, flies around, comes down, and 4 years later, people are still writing negative articles about it. They're going back and writing that it's a fraud.
Yeah, and in this case, really easy, as you point out. I mean, the thing is flying. I mean, you can't deny it. And even if it's a fraud, well, how did he do the fraud? I mean, you know?
Right.
Great. Then the fraud is the real thing. Anyway, but...
So Tiwari's machine is easy to measure for you know, electrical engineers and technicians.
So can you briefly explain how this setup is, how this setup looks like? When you do the measurement of Tiwari's machine, so.
Well, we have meters that measure voltage and current of the input, and then we have meters that measure voltage and current of the output, and these meters are what we call revenue quality. I mean, the term revenue quality means that they trust these meters enough to build a customer at the nuclear power plant. These are the same kind of meters they use at the nuclear power plant to measure power. And these revenue quality meters, you know, calculate based on the measurement of voltage and current. They calculate the watts and the kilowatts that are coming out of the machine. KW and KVA are calculated what's coming out of the machine and what's going into the machine with two separate sets of meters. So in the film, you see the meters that he uses in the test setup that he uses. And I also brought my own set of meters, graciously provided by a fellow electrical engineer that's a motor designer and tester. And we used these separate meters to verify that the meters that he had were accurate. And so I can say with confidence that the meters I supplied and the meters he's using were basically getting the same results.
So just that I understand, you put one meter at the input of the engine that so to say starts the generator.
Yes.
And then the other set of meters at the output of the generator.
Yes. And those.
And then the current that goes into the engine, so I mean this, yeah, that goes into the engine is smaller than the current that comes out of the generator that is driven by the engine.
The power going into the engine. The engine that you refer to is an electric motor, so yeah. It's a drive motor.
Exactly. So yeah. There's an electric motor driving the generator, the power generator. I mean, normally you do it the other way around. And the energy that goes into the motor is less than the energy that comes out of the generator. Is that basically the setup?
All yes. Right.
So that's quite easy to measure because those values are quite high. Yeah. So.
Right.
And
they're very.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're, you know, these are 5 and 10,000 kilowatts. So 5,000 watts, 10,000 watts. This is not a trivial measurement.
Mm-hmm. And you used your own meters and you looked at the whole thing. There are no cables going in, going out, and you are confident that he did it the right way. I mean, it sounds like a fairly simple measurement.
It is. Yeah. Very simple. Very simple.
And he had, in the film, I think he gets an over-unity effect of something like 200% or 160%, yeah. I think.
I think it was 2.38% shows up on that clipboard or that whiteboard when he's writing on the whiteboard. Yeah, that was Sai Baba's birthday. We ran the test twice.
So 238%.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So the output of the generator, if you put in 1 watt, you get out 2.3 watts.
Exactly.
Wow. And that's just working. And then you could build a closed circuit where you just start it and then the thing is running and it could use part of the power it generates to power the engine, and the rest is then freely available. Correct?
That's correct. And Tiwari has another innovation that is working into this device, which would allow, basically it's another set of windings within the machine, but it would take away the need to do a self-looping to power the input. In other words, once it got started, it would generate enough power without looping back to be self-running.
What do you mean without looping back?
Yeah, so you wouldn't have to loop the output to the input and make it self-running. He has a new circuit that he's working on that would basically power the machine by itself. So once you got it spinning, you would not have to use the drive motor.
Interesting. No idea how that would work, but okay.
Very interesting. Yep, yep.
Uh-huh. Because so the generator would also be an engine.
The generator. Yeah, the generator would have a motor circuit built into it, so it would spin itself.
Okay. That's fascinating. I mean, that's really fascinating. So, and this thing is running. In Graz there was the film presentation of Out of the Void, and the reaction of the camera of one of the cameraman was really interesting. I mean, he is a technician, a skeptical guy, and he said, "Well, the first thing is, I was quite astonished that, you know, sensible people, I mean, real engineers, are interested in this at all, because isn't it all just, you know, bull?" And then the second thing he said is, well, and then when I looked at that and it really worked, and I mean, of course, he's not an electrical engineer, but he could see that the output was bigger than the input. I mean, he really thought, well, maybe I'm really filming something significant here.
Yeah, so, Frank. Boy, that cameraman, that's a hell of a job, I'll tell you.
Yeah. I mean, the film is beautiful done. I mean, the music, everything. I mean, it's a beautiful film. It's not available on DVD yet, but I mean, guys, anyone who has the chance to see it, go see it. It's the best thing I've ever seen about free energy. It's because it is an artistic thing. It's not, you know, oh yeah, lots of claims flying around. It really brings you into the mood of those guys. Fascinating. Anyway, but what needs to be done, of course, is to go beyond that, to really say, okay, now we have a running prototype. What happened with this prototype so far?
Well, the one that's in the movie has been superseded by a new one, which if people go to the website, they'll see the new one. So he's made another one.
Mm-hmm. I've seen it, yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, this is the third one he's made, so basically you can say it's definitely not a mistake. You can make one every time. So what's next is basically, you know, he's searching for funding. And that's, as we've talked, that's a major issue. How do we get the funding? Perhaps somebody in your listening audience knows how we can get some funding.
Well, as I said, I mean, if this is so easily to be measured, I mean, you know, because, for example, in the case of Tour, well, for one thing, there are only very small energies that can be measured, and he hasn't built the real thing yet based on the magnetic field. So, yeah, okay, in this case, it's a bit difficult. Still, I would love to see more work being done there. But in the case of Tiwari, it seems that it's quite straightforward. I mean, you have this thing, it produces, so if I understand it right, it produces several kilowatt of energy, yeah?
Right.
Yep. Okay. Just like that. So yep. Basically out of the void. It's so amazing. It's really amazing.
One of the problems is that people have to go to India to see it, and that's a major hurdle for most people. Most venture capital types or people that are interested in investing, when they think go to India, you know, they see that as quite a trip. I mean, it is quite a trip. It can take 48 hours door to door from the United States to get to his place. He's in the middle of nowhere. He's in a protected area that because of critical infrastructure. So it's not an easy place to get to. It's in a jungle on a river, and it's about a 3-hour drive from the nearest airport. And so it takes quite a bit of effort to go to India. It's expensive to go to India, time consuming. You have to get a visa. That's not easy. You have to jump through hoops to get your visa to get there. So that's the first object. It's not like if it's in the United States, somebody could get on a plane and, you know, fly from New York to Seattle and then make the test and come back in the same day. But, you know, in India, to get there and come back, it's, you know, you're looking at a minimum of 4 days. So that's got to be done. You know, somebody with money's got to send a crew of engineers there to test the machine and then invest the money. The question is, where do you find those kind of people?
Of course, that's always the question. But as I said, I mean, in this case, the price is quite high, I would say. I mean, the award that you could possibly have. But I can understand that people, you know, are skeptical. They've heard that a million times before. And there are thousands of inventors who claim they have built it. I talked to a couple of them. And I had a couple of them promising me, yeah, we're going to demonstrate it to you within 1 year, within 2 years. I haven't seen anything. So, well. But, yeah, it sounds promising. And if you say that the thing works, so he has a running prototype there for everyone. And if someone goes through the trouble to travel to India, he could see it, yeah?
Yeah, well, he can't show it to just anybody. He's 80 years old and he's not well. So it would have to be, if somebody wanted to see it, they'd have to be somebody that's willing to invest.
Yeah. Okay,
but
I take it that there is someone who will pick up the ball after him?
That's a good question.
Well,
yeah.
That's a really important thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
So someone asked in the chat whether the thing is open source. Is it open source?
No, that comes up a lot in the last couple of years since the whole open source software thing. And the problem with the open source is that if an inventor needs funding, the investor wants to know that he's going to get his money back, and therefore he wants to see a patent in place. And so this type of device is almost the antithesis of what you would need for open source. How can anybody make any money if it's open source? Because anybody can build it. So why should an investor invest money in building it?
Well, because if you have the edge on this, you're going to sell a whole lot of those units until the other one get where you are. I mean, the question is, how much money do you want to make, you know? I don't understand this argument, because honestly, I don't think that this will work with a patent, because take Rossi in Italy. Did you hear of the E-Cut? Cold Fusion? Mm-hmm. I mean, he goes down the patent road, as far as I... Mm-hmm. And I think Skunkworks are interested in his stuff.
Don't know.
That's what I heard. But, you know, it just vanishes and never to be heard again. I mean, Eugene Maloff, for example, he talked about cold fusion things years ago. I mean, and then, he died. And... it's all gone. Nothing ever came out, and you know, it's just stuck there. And I don't know. I mean, you might think about Stephen Greer, whatever you might think about him, and he's certainly a very, well, a strange guy in a way. I mean, but he's deep into strange stuff. So, well, what do you expect? And one of his initiatives, and I watched some videos lately because I don't know. I just sometimes I just watch stuff on the net, and I just get from on YouTube from one video to the other, and then suddenly I ended up at Stephen Greer, and he's doing this new movement to, I mean, he's bringing together the UFO question with the free energy or alternative energy question, and you might argue if that's a good idea or not. I have no idea. But he says a lot of things. I mean, he says a lot of things that are quite crazy, but okay, I don't know. But he also says things that make sense. And one of the things he says is the way he wants to approach this is, so he offers about, I think, 100K for everyone that comes to him with, I think, a working prototype and an open source concept. And then he offers to build it and then to publicize it, but really big time. And I think that makes an awful lot of sense. What do you think?
Well, I see both sides of it. I see both sides of the story. I tend to lean towards away from the open source. One thing that you have to realize is that this is not an easy thing to build. You know, your average Joe could not build it.
Your average Joe couldn't build it. So if you have the edge on this, and if you're really working on this, you're going to make a lot of money. That's what I'm saying, even if you don't have the patent.
But what good does the open source do then?
Well, as you said, I mean, who will pick up the ball after Tiwari? So who say in a couple of years, you know, who knows, he dies. Or I hope he will live a long life from here and do a lot of things. But, you know, at some point he will die. And then, as it happens many times before, all of those things just vanish. And you know, nothing happens with it. So wouldn't it be better that he just puts it out there and says, okay, here it is?
Well, yes and no, I guess. His associates have all the patent papers and all the design equations, and so, you know, his kids have that access to all that information.
And do they understand it?
His family does. Yeah, one of his sons is a power engineer.
All right. So basically his son is going to pick up the ball, yeah?
Yeah, that's what you would expect, is that, you
hopefully,
know,
yeah.
Yeah, yep.
Yeah. Well, there's also a PDF we put up. Should we briefly talk about that, or are we already far beyond that?
Yeah, let's talk about that just a little bit.
Okay.
You can introduce it here while I look for something.
Yeah, so this is a PDF that is beneath the show text. So if you're listening to it live, you just go on the start page and click on the link is called Fifth Generation Power Generation from Space, the Fifth Element. And if you listen to it from the archive, you just do the same thing. You go beneath the show description, and there's the link. And that's what's it about?
Well, this is in the lower right hand corner. You'll see this is courtesy of Melita Rao. Melita Rao was an associate of Tiwari's in that area, because he was the technical director of the Karnataka Power Corporation, and they have the dam, the hydroelectric dam nearby where Tiwari lives. And Melita Rao put that chart together for us. A little bit more on Melita. Basically, he was with KPC, Karnataka Power Corporation, and recently retired. KPC is the company that powers the entire state of Karnataka, including the large city of Bangalore. So he is also an electrical engineer, and he's measured this machine and seen the measurements. But what we're talking about, I think, Let me just read a small segment from the book Universal Principles of Space and Matter, a conceptual reorientation by Paramahamsa Tewari. And if you go to his website, you'll be directed to, you can see where his books are for sale. But reading from his introduction, and this goes back to Tewari's whole vision of how the void forms matter being based upon ancient Vedic scriptures. So his original inspiration comes from the ancient Vedas, going back to, as we talked earlier, about Swami Vivekananda being a teacher of Vedic science. In his book, he says, and I quote, "It may appear surprising if I raise the age-old question, what is the basic entity or substance of which the universe is composed? But has this question not remained unanswered in a straightforward way, except, of course, partly and qualitatively by Descartes and his vortex theory in the 17th century? The ancients, too, had pondered over this question. The Upanishads, which are an ancient Vedic text, pinpoint Akash, space medium, absolute vacuum, as the first entity from which matter in the forms of air, fire, water, and earth is produced." So what this chart that you're referring to basically illustrates is that the elements earth, water, fire, and air all have sources. For instance, the element earth provides oil and gas. And the types of generation of all these sources is listed in this table. The type of generation would be thermal plants, gas turbines, which would come from the earth elements. Then we have a column that lists the availability, and then we have some remarks on each one of these elements. So the element earth we covered just now. Water is the rivers, type of generation, hydroelectric. The availability is limited, and they're exploited. The rivers fill up, the dams behind them fill up with sand. The next element we're talking about is fire. And the source, of course, is solar energy from the sun. And solar photovoltaic cells are the type of generation. They're abundant. They're clean, less polluting, no fuel costs. The fifth element we have is air, and that is recognized as wind and windmills. Wind is abundant, being exploited, no fuel cost. Now, the fifth element is space. The source is space itself. The physicists might refer to this as the Higgs field. And the Sanskrit folks...
Oh, we got a cat.
Yeah, got a cat. Cat just
came. She wants to say something.
Yeah, the cat woke up. Been asleep 6 hours now. Time to get up.
All right.
space is the Akash, and the type of generation is the reactionless generator. The availability is infinite, and the remark is clean, no pollution. Now, this basically was inspired by the Upanishads, and Tewari's work was inspired by the Upanishads. His work has been inspired by the ancient Sanskrit teachings.
That's very fascinating, yeah.
Yeah.
But it does make sense.
Yeah, the ancient Sanskrit teachings basically explained how the universe worked.
Yeah.
Now, this kind of ties into my supposition that this is the next big thing, because the first big thing for humans was the ability to control fire. The second big thing was the wheel. Now they could transport the fire. The third big thing was electricity, which took fire and wheels to be able to build and begin the Industrial Revolution. The fourth big thing was nuclear power, nuclear energy, and the ability to destroy ourselves. The fifth big thing that goes along with the fifth element is the ability to obtain our energy anywhere in space without consuming resources. And this is what Tesla prophesied.
And wouldn't that be the perfect way to destroy ourselves?
That's the question. Jevons paradox.
Yeah, exactly. So let's talk about that.
One has to. I believe that consciousness evolves, and so does the vessel to hold it. So here we are in this human body, and consciousness is still evolving. And I believe that we will get past our childlike tendencies that we have today, and eventually we will live in a world that is much better off than what we're living in today as consciousness evolves.
Yeah. Hello?
Yes.
Okay, yeah, that's the hope. But, you know, are we really there? Because as we just talked about it, we are still talking about patents and profit. Is that the right mindset to get into this? Is my maybe stupid question.
Well, we're caught in a crack between two worlds. You know, we're, like I said, the dawning of the age of Aquarius. I mean, we've got to leave these Piscean ways behind and move into this newer way of doing things. And so...
But that's really not patents, is it?
No. No, one could argue that the inventor is just a channel for the information that's coming through him. So he should be grateful to have been given the brain capacity to figure it out. But is that invention his?
Well, yes and no. I mean, but Tuto, for example, he goes the open source way. He just puts it all out there, and you know, still no one comes to build his stuff. So, but the stuff Tiwari has built, I mean, he has a running prototype. There's a real good motivation. If you see this machine running, producing several kilowatts, I mean, poof, that's. But coming back to what's the paradox called again?
Jevons, G-E-A-V-I-N-S. Wikipedia has a real good article on Jevons.
What does it say? I mean,
basically Jevons' paradox says that for every increase in efficiency, you have an increased population and increased resource depletion.
Exactly. So it's kind of a catch-22.
Exactly, catch-22. Yeah. Uh-huh.
And wouldn't free energy supercharge that?
Yes.
So how do we get out of that? I mean, okay, we can wait until we all become, you know, enlightened. People thought we would do that in 2012. Well, they were disappointed, which was an interesting thing on itself. But... if that doesn't happen, if we don't just get enlightened, so we just stay ourselves and we have to come up with a way of how to deal with that ourselves, how would we do it?
Whoa, how would we do it?
I know, it's I mean, that's the $64,000 question. I mean, I know.
One thing we have to realize is that continued growth is not good, because the capitalist economy of producing X more stuff to consume every year is going to result in total resource depletion. So there has to be an evolution of consciousness, number one, just to realize that the capitalist system is broken and will destroy us all. How's that to start?
Yeah, it's a start for sure, but we have heard that for a long time now. The capitalist system is broken, and it is broken. I mean, we can just watch it go down. I mean, that's a prophecy to make. Where you will probably be right is that this whole financial system is quite in a turmoil and will be changing, and it probably won't implode. I don't think it will implode, but it will change. That's for sure. And within this change, there's a chance. I mean, when we talked about on the phone before the show, I picked up on this news item that was all over the web and the press, that the Rockefellers are getting out of ExxonMobil. Allegedly, right. I mean, that's at least what they say. Maybe they don't do it in the end, but they said that they will sell their shares on ExxonMobil, which which raised some eyebrows for me, because well, if they do that, why would they do it? Why, I mean, do they see something else on the horizon, or do they just think that it thing? I mean, if they do that, then I mean, they must have a good reason. So they must. I don't know. I don't know what the reason could be, but probably one possible reason would be that the revenue coming out of this business will decline. And the question is, why would it decline?
You know, that whole group, the people running things, the boomers, you know, that and that whole mindset is changing in the upper levels of management. Because people that have been involved in environmental issues all their lives are now in key places in these corporations and the and in these funds, and they know that fossil fuels are killing us.
Yeah.
So I mean, to me, that's I assume that's why they're getting out of it. And
wow, so that's really optimistic. So you think it's because they
know. Yeah,
they change their evil ways.
Well, they're changing their evil ways, yes. and I think that it's going to be a slow movement, but energy source transition times take 20, 30, 50 years to go from wood to coal, from coal to oil, from oil to natural gas, from natural gas, fossil fuels, to renewable energy or space power generators. It doesn't happen overnight. It takes 30, 40, 50 years.
So if the Rockefellers, who are famous for allegedly ruling the world, are getting out of this, it might be a sign of things to come.
Oh, yeah. Now, you know, I've been reading a book by the ex-finance minister of Greece.
Oh, Varoufakis.
Yes.
Very interesting guy.
Yeah, that new book that he wrote. So, you know, basically, the whole financial structure of Europe is geared towards failure, according to his book, and geared toward, you know, major implosion.
Well, so, you could argue also other financial systems, but yeah.
Yeah, I mean, ours is too, but apparently the European central bank system is worse off than the Federal Reserve system in the United States, which is not very good either, because all our previous national banks all failed for the same reason that this one will fail.
But yeah, but the dollar is the lead currency, so you certainly have a bonus there.
Yeah, that is. It is. Yeah, so he's, you know, he's warning of dire consequences unless these finance ministers get their act together among all those European countries.
Yeah. He's right, I think.
But I still want to come back to Austria.
Oh, yeah, you should. Next time we have to meet. But now, you don't think that there is a conspiracy to suppress free energy, yeah?
No. I have not seen any evidence of it, and I have worked with many, many inventors. I've tested many machines. I've traveled around the world. And, you know, Hal Putoff from the Institute of Advanced Energy in Austin, who studied Uri Geller and did a lot of research on free energy machines, much more than I have, much, much more. He basically gave a briefing to the vice president of Exxon Oil Company and his crew, and they said, you know, if free energy was available, we'd put it in our oil refineries right now. Because if we don't have to pay electricity costs to make our product, we'd be more profitable.
Yeah, but no one would use the product in a couple of years.
They know nothing lasts forever, and they know they're going to run out of it, and it'll be too cost prohibitive to extract it. So, you know, the early adopters would be the people that use lots of energy, which would be the oil companies.
Well, I can see people jumping up and down now because there are so many inventors that allegedly were stopped, even killed, and so on and so forth. So you think all of those stories, they are just either
It's not because they had free energy. You know, they got in fights with their investors. They got in fights with their family members. I know of one inventor that, you know, ate fast food for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and was at a fast food restaurant, and he jumped up and said, "I've been poisoned," ran out in the parking lot and died. Well, you know, you can't eat that food all your life. But some of these egos are so inflated that they think that the government is trying to suppress them. There's a psychological profile.
So it's hubris.
It's what?
Hubris. Hubris. Yeah.
Yes, yes. You know, if the government's watching you and me and, you know, tapping our conversation right now, we must be pretty important, don't you think?
Yeah, they don't have to tap our conversation. It's transmitted over the web. So.
Right. Yeah, that's right.
I mean, like, so,
you know.
Save the effort. Just listen to my show.
Right.
Yeah. No, I don't. No, I'm not talking about this level here. No, I mean, I don't say that it is suppressed or that it isn't suppressed. I don't know. I just wonder.
My theory is that efficiency always wins in the marketplace. If you've got something that worked, it will be adopted. And the reason that free energy hasn't been adopted yet is because nobody has anything that works.
But that would also mean that Tiwari is the first guy that got it to work, yeah?
Yeah. And the Swiss ML converter was one, and T. Henry Moray was one, and Sparky Sweet was one.
But what happened to those?
Sweets was very unstable. Nobody could replicate it. T. Henry Moray, nobody replicated it. The Tiwari machine is very easy to replicate. It's already been done. So, yes, Tiwari is the first one.
That is really something. I mean, in my YouTube journeys, I, for example, stumbled over Eric Dollard, that you also heard of.
Right, yes.
And he is a very good example. And I knew people like that. I mean, I had them on my show, okay? A guy who would, claim things. I mean, whether it's true or not is a different story. And he would, people who believed in Dollard really came up with a lot of money, and they gave him his laboratory and everything. But then he just didn't do it.
Can you say Carl Schappeller?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Carl Schappeller, same thing. I mean, exactly. he made claims. He had some interesting ideas, but then he didn't do it, or he couldn't do it. Yeah, that's right.
Right.
But it's strange. I mean, it's that all of those years, people were trying to do it, and no one got it right. It makes me wonder if Tiwari got it right. You know what I mean? I mean,
Well, you know, I've wondered that myself, and then I made the measurements, and I met other people that made the measurements, and I respect them highly, and it appears he got it right.
All right. So,
So the movie is the best place to see all that information. My understanding is that they are looking for distributors in Europe for the movie, hoping to find somebody to distribute it. And if they don't, eventually it'll go on Netflix.
Put it on Netflix. That's a good idea.
That's going to be the best way to see the Tiwari machine in action and the factory where they built the duplicate.
John Bedini, just to throw in another name.
Yes, I know him. He was at the first... Eric Dollard was at the second Tesla symposium, and John Bedini was at the first... symposium back in 1984, so I've met him back then.
Yeah, but his thing also didn't work?
You know, I've never measured it myself. I know people that have measured it and say, no, it doesn't work, but I really don't know what's going on with the Bedini machine.
Yeah, but sure, there are also people who claim that about Tiwari's work, you know, so that's the thing.
Well, I've never met anybody that measured it that said it didn't work.
All right.
That's the difference, I think, is that, you know, the people that can measure the machine will tell you it works.
Yeah, for sure, yes. So, I mean, so be it. I mean, so Tiwari is...
You know, I was surprised to find the Bedini machine in a museum in Vienna. It's sitting there running.
Okay. And so it obviously works.
Well, it's got batteries connected to it.
Okay. Well, but the Bedini machine works with batteries, doesn't it? I mean,
it's just a long-running machine. I guess it's a highly efficient machine.
It needs batteries to keep the circuit going as far because
right.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, but if it's sitting there, then it's working, isn't it? Ah, this is strange.
Yeah, it's a piece. It was turned into a piece of artwork. It's an excellent piece of artwork.
I wonder what she's saying, or he.
She's saying that, you know, I live in the land of the Wizard of Oz, and there's the tornadoes are coming. It looks like the wind is really blowing hard, and maybe she senses the Wicked Witch of the West.
The Wicked Witch? That wouldn't be Lilith, would it?
No, it wouldn't.
Okay. Anyway, I mean, I think... That's probably a good place to end this conversation today because to get to the end of this conversation. I mean, we are now talking for 140 minutes. Can you believe it?
No, I can't.
See, time flies in Crop FM. That's how it happens. So we didn't need the break neither. But in going,
we need the break now, I'll tell you. But I really enjoyed this conversation, and I'm really glad to be able to, you know, be able to tell you what I've learned and known about. So thank you very much for having me come to the show.
And thank you very much for being on my show. And I hope, if Tiwari Singh is working and I can't, you know, I didn't measure it myself, okay? Neither did I measure Tutor Singh myself or any other of those things. So if Tiwari Singh is working and anything happens with this thing, please contact me so we can make an update because I'd really like to... Well, I'll try to stay on top on his website, but yeah. I'd really like to follow this because, yeah, maybe Tiwari... Okay, Tiwari Singh is the first thing that is really working. And I have to say, I haven't ever heard of a running generator that was running in public and that where people could... So your point is well taken. It maybe this is the first thing because it's the first time... I forgot something, but it's the first time I see a machine that puts out kilowatts, not, you know, picowatts or something like that, but really kilowatts that is running that people saw where... People who know about, who are electrical engineers and not some amateurs. I mean, I'm not saying anything against amateurs, but they're amateurs. You have 40 years of experience in this stuff, and if you say, "Well, I measured it with my own equipment, and it does what it says it does, and there weren't any wires going in," then wow, that's amazing. So yeah, if that's the first thing that's working, and it well could be, it could actually, the argument should be other way around. It actually could be really working, and not just a claim.
Right.
And
right.
People really have to realize what that would mean. I mean, this is huge. This is mega huge.
It's the next big thing. That's why I say.
Yeah, of course it's the next big thing. This will change everything. I mean, our financial system. Well, yeah, it needs to change because it's called the petrodollar. Guess why?
right.
Because we all need fuel, and we have to buy it, and we have to use the dollar to buy it, and that's how the whole thing is working. And if we suddenly can, you know, plug into a machine that just puts out kilowatts just because it does, well, things would change.
Yes.
And yeah. I mean, people are jumping up and down in the chat, of course. They say, oh, no, of course there's a conspiracy. I mean, guys, I don't know if there's a conspiracy. All I can say is, well, There were a lot of claims in the past, and there was, you know, this in London a couple of years ago, maybe you heard about it, there was a machine with this public demonstration, I think an Irish guy, do you know what I mean?
No, I didn't hear about that one.
And it was running at a public demonstration, but it broke down, I forgot the name, I'm sorry. So all of those things, when they were ready to be tested, they didn't work. The E-cut, for example, I had the guy who tried to sell the E-cut, but it all went south because Rossi sold it to Skunkworks. I don't know what's going on there, but yeah, you can't see the E-cut because you have to go there, and there is no public demonstration of this thing, you know, yet.
Right.
I have to say there's also no public demonstration yet of Tavares thing. So what should happen is there should be a big event. I mean, you know, otherwise it will go into oblivion again as all the other things that might have worked or not. I don't know. Oh my God. I mean, it really gets me excited, but. I would really love to see this going somewhere, for God's sake. I mean, you know what I mean?
Oh, I do. I know exactly what you mean. I've been there for a long time.
Oh, you've been there for decades. God.
You know, at one time, there was a famous inventor telling everybody I was a CIA agent because I had a job at an aerospace company, so...
That makes sense, doesn't it?
You know, sure, of course. Yeah, I must be the bad guy. I got a job, right?
Yeah, look, the photo I put up with your Chappella head. You look like a man in black.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Well, so I just to reiterate, I've worked in all these different industries, and I've been around the world, and I just don't believe there's an active suppression going on. And I can tell you this. Tawari's not going to be suppressed. He retired as executive director of the Nuclear Power Corporation of India. He's a national asset. He's known all over India. And so the Indians aren't going to let this be suppressed.
Why aren't the Indians doing it?
Well, the same reason. Well, two reasons. One is they're all Western science trained, I should say. And so they don't believe it because... they got told a long time ago it was impossible. That's impossible to fly. But the other reason is the Indian character. And I was told this by young Indians when I traveled there many times and met people in the airports and met engineers. They said that the thing about India is they don't do anything unless they see other people making money at it first. Mm. And so they're not risk takers. And so it's very difficult to get any money in India as well for the fact that they're not risk takers and they don't believe it because they were trained by Western scientists.
So if someone would come and really start to build this big time, you don't think that he would run into any problems, you know?
Absolutely not. It's a manufacturing issue. Basically, you got to get into manufacturing and build it. That's all it takes. I mean, we have it. You can see it in the movie. It can be done by a factory that makes motors and generators. It's not a big deal to move this forward.
Oh, boy. Well, yeah.
I mean, you know, if you want to change the world and repower the world, it's not a threat to anybody because by the time... all these generators are placed where they need to be, will be out of gas and oil anyway. So it's not a threat to the oil and gas industry. It's not a threat to the utility companies. It's not a threat to anybody.
Well, it's a threat to the petrodollar, isn't it? But
because the energy transition time is so long, it won't affect the petrodollar. I don't believe it. It's going to take too long to replace everything with this machine. You just can't make enough of them fast enough.
Mm. So there's enough time to change around this system, yeah.
Right. And the petrodollar guys, they're going to move their money into electric car companies and move their money into, you know, the smart money is going to move into this.
Into spaceships. I mean, you could build really cool spaceships with such technologies if you can just generate energy in a clean way, not a nuclear power plant that's impossible in space because you have to shield it and everything and yada yada. So if you could put that up and have one of those new electric propulsion systems, wow, you could go to Mars in a week. Maybe two.
The other thing is that Tewari's space vortex theory explains how gravity works and confirms the gravity modification experiments that were done by Wilbert Smith. So that's a whole nother subject, but you know, gravity is part of this whole theory that Tewari has elucidated in his book. So I'd encourage people to go to the website. There are probably 20 papers there that are free to download to study space vortex theory and how the electron forms from the void. And there's also a section that takes him to his books, which can be purchased for a few bucks a piece, maybe 5-10 euros, so that they can read even further on his theories.
And that's actually something that I had on my notes here, which is the electrogravity, I think it's called, yeah? That's a question. I mean, so, but there are other applications of this technology, yeah?
Well, not the technology he's invented. The technology he's invented negates Lenz's law.
Yeah, okay.
However, his space vortex theory explains gravitational fields, and he is able to see and explain the effects of anti-gravity or gravity control that were done. These are experiments that were done by Wilbert Smith, who was an official in the Canadian government. He was an electrical engineer.
Yeah, I know. Fascinating stuff, yeah.
Yeah, so basically, Tewari feels that his theory, his space vortex theory, explains Smith's ability to control gravity, to increase or decrease gravity above a disk with spinning magnets.
And haven't people seen that flying around?
Yeah, right. Yeah.
So, well, okay.
Mostly over Belgium, from what I understand.
Yeah, Belgium in the 80s and the early 90s, they saw a lot of that. But not just in Belgium, also in the Hudson River or in Phoenix or, you know.
Yeah, right.
Okay, yeah. That is actually a fascinating subject, but for another show, I would say.
Okay, all right.
And for today, I really... Many, many thanks for your time, and I really enjoyed this show. I enjoyed this conversation. I really hope that finally there is something out in the open, because, I mean, you know, if Tesla talked about this over 100 years ago, it's hard to believe that no one engineered it, but maybe that's how it is. Who knows? Maybe you really need the insight into Vedic wisdom to get your head around those things. I don't know.
I think so. And I'd just like to thank your listeners for tuning in, and anybody listening to this podcast, thank you very much for your interest in these subjects.
Yeah, and they can get in touch with you, I guess. So can I put up your mail address, or is there any way to... Do you want people to get in?
Yeah, that wireless2@mindspring.com is a good email address.
All right. So I'll put that on the website so people mm-hmm. can get in touch with you.
Yep.
Okay, so let's see what happens with Tewari. If the thing really works and it can be confirmed by others, I mean, I really hope that something is going to happen. And then maybe why don't we do another show on these other applications that really sound fascinating sometime, maybe later this year or early next year.
Okay.
And then we can catch up on Tewari. Who knows what happens until then?
If something happens in the meantime, I will let you know.
Okay. So thank you very much, and have a nice day. So you're near Chicago now, yeah?
Yeah, mid-afternoon now.
Mid-afternoon, okay.
All right. Man.
Okay, enjoy your time.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Crop FM. Radio. Aus der Vorstadt. Der Wirklichkeit. We'll be right back.
Wow. Ja, wenn das wirklich funktioniert, das wäre Wahnsinn. Hoffen wir, es passiert dann auch irgendwas damit. Das wäre sehr schön, sehr spannend. Das nächste Mal, Crop FM, ist Dr. Sabine Bobert zu Gast. Sie war schon mal zu Gast und wir sprachen über die Mystik des Abendlandes. Und jetzt sprechen wir über ihre, ja, über ihre Coaching-Technik, die sie aus diesen Dingen entwickelt hat. Mystik und Coaching heißt die Sendung. Zu hören am Samstag, dem 28. Mai 2016. Samstag, Achtung, nicht der Freitag, also in genau 15 Tagen von jetzt. Ja, freue mich auf die Sendung mit Sabine. Es wird dann übrigens auch ganz wichtig, es gibt da einen Thread im Chat, im Forum. Es wird dann auch ein Seminar von Sabine Bobert geben in Graz. Irgendwann im Juli, glaube ich. Aber wenn man ins Forum geht und unter Religion, glaube ich, findet man das. Und ich werde es dann eher auch noch ankündigen zur Sendung mit Sabine Bobert. Jedenfalls am 28. Mai ist sie zu Gast und wir sprechen über Mystik und Coaching. Die hat auch ein Buch geschrieben. Wie gesagt, es ist ein Samstag. Ich bedanke mich bei allen fürs Zuhören und fürs Interesse. Bis zum nächsten Mal. Macht es gut.
The curtain's gonna fall.